Everybody, welcome to Church History for Chumps. My name is John Simon, and I'm here with my good friend,
Tom Stewart.
Yeah, I was thinking about
we got to get the energy up.
Oh, was that too low?
Yeah.
I'll start over. Hey, everybody. Hey,
bow, bow,
bow. Hey, everybody. This is John Simon, and welcome to Church History for Chumps. And this is my partner,
Thomas Doyle. Oh,
you sounded like you were selling like lemonade. Like there's the guy at the D-back stadium up in Phoenix, the famous one. You know what I'm talking about?
He sells lemonade?
Lemonade, just like grandma made.
Oh, that's awesome.
That's going to sound on the recording.
I bet it's going to sound super good. It's got the levels look great for it. Yeah. Hey, man, how you doing?
Church history.
One day we'll get big and we'll hire that guy.
Mm-hmm.
We'll bring him out and we'll...
I think he's probably expensive. But
you think so?
Dude, if that guy was on like Cameo or whatever it's called.
Yeah.
Man, he could probably pull.
He's just the lemonade guy, right?
Mm-hmm. But he's like famous. Do you know how much lemonade he sold?
I don't know. I don't think he gets commission on lemonade. I feel like he just works for the stadium.
I don't know.
I don't know either.
Sorry, a lot of chaos, but carry on.
No. It's all good. Shoot, how you doing, man? You doing all right?
Doing good.
Yeah. Things have been pretty good all right this week. Haven't done a shout out in a while. Who should we shout out? Should we shout out like a, I don't know. Yeah, what do you think?
I want to shout out Dr. Michael Goheen.
Oh, wow. Yeah. The man himself.
Mm-hmm.
The man, the myth, the Michael.
Yep. He was my professor for the last 4 years. He was your professor for 4 years.
Yeah.
And I'm shouting him out because I'm graduating from the seminary that he created this week.
A little bit of a humble brag there. I'd like to shout out my professor as I'm graduating.
Yeah.
So I'm getting my degree. awesome, dude.
I wanted to share that news, but then like... What'd you say?
I said F's in the chat.
Why would we have F's in the chat?
Isn't F like a good thing?
No. F's in the chat. F's in the chat is meme culture for not good.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, F is like pay your respects.
Yeah.
Like it's like a condolences.
I don't know why, but it is. Yeah. No, but I'm actually really thankful for him.
Oh, no. I know what it's from. It's from a Call of Duty cutscene from I forget where you literally it says if you're playing on PC press F to pay respects. Oh.
Yeah, you're right. I'll just look it up.
I forgot about that, and my meme knowledge is getting rusty. That feels bad. So that happens when you get 30 and then 31. You're not even in your 30s yet, are you, Tommy?
Nope.
Next year. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Sweet. Well, hey, I'll echo that shout out. And shout out to you, man. 4 years of hard work.
Thanks, dude.
You made it to the finish line.
Yeah. You were my inspiration.
Oh, thanks, dude. Yeah.
The anchor at the end of the rope.
I'm always happy to be the stern at the back of your boat.
Moving on.
Hey, so I wanted to talk about, Tommy's dying right now. I love it. I wanted to talk about a story that some of you guys who listened to our episode on Will Gefortis will, I think, appreciate. It's a story that is kind of an equal parts folklore, because when we get to medieval and pre-medieval Christianity, especially all throughout Europe, there's lots of folklore. There's lots of stories that sound kind of fanciful and fantastic, and you know, the post-Enlightenment thinkers that we are, you know, very educated and discerning, we're often very doubtful of the kind of the miraculous things that happened. But I think it's kind of cool to, you know, suspend our natural inclination towards disbelief. But today we're going to be talking about a young woman by the name of Saint Dimphna, who came from the Isle of Ireland. And so, like I said, this is a story kind of steeped in folklore, but also kind of leads to a historical reality and the forming of a culture in the small Belgian town that really does kind of epitomize a really cool aspect of the kingdom of God. Hmm. So I'm excited to talk more about that.
Sweet.
So I'm going to start with a story that's going to kind of sound like a fairy tale. And, you know, listener, it's up to you to decide if you buy it or not. But I don't really think that's the point, and I'll get more into that later. But so we start off in the 7th century. And just like the story that we mentioned earlier, we're starting with a pagan king in Ireland who, I think his name was Damon. He was a pagan king, obviously not a Christian. His wife was a Christian, though. I guess they just, I don't know, they didn't really talk about that in premarital counseling. So they had a single child, a little girl named Dimphna. Dimphna's mother secretly raised her daughter as a Christian and even baptized her, unknown to her father. While Dimphna was still quite young, her mother tragically and unexpectedly died. The story goes that the king was overcome with just overwhelming lament and grief, and some say that the grief began to slowly drive him mad. Unable to find a suitable replacement for his wife as queen, he had this evil thought, which was, what if I married my daughter, who carries the image of my beautiful, long-lost wife?
Tis an evil thought.
Tis an evil, evil thought. And so when Dimphna heard this, and I think she was probably around like 13 at the time, so mega gross, not mm-hmm. just like incest gross, but also like underage gross, mm-hmm. Drizzy Drake gross.
Oh, he said when, that.
So when she heard about this, she was horrified, and together with her priest, a man by the name of Garabran, fled from Ireland, sailed to Europe, and settled in a Belgian town known as Geel, where they found they landed there because they found a shrine dedicated to another really important figure in European Christianity, Saint Martin of Tours, probably one of the most significant French saints from around that time period. So when she arrives there in Geel, her and her priest kind of get established in this small little communal town, and they build a sanctuary where they would care for the sick in their community. And it kind of starts a reputation. The reputation, unfortunately, is so big that it ends up getting back to Ireland, and the evil king Damon would find his daughter and travel all across Europe to the town that she was in with some of his, I don't know, his buff army guys coming with him. He gives her one last try, you know, marry me as your father, or that's it for you. And not only was she a Christian and just, you know, a rational human being, and she declined that, she also had made a vow of celibacy, a vow of virginity. And something that's also really interesting that I see a lot in, not just stories of like folk saints, but specifically saintly figures that were young women, is that this idea of like preserving their virginity at all costs or against all costs is like a huge like selling point for like the virtue of these people. Hmm. So it wasn't just enough that she was fleeing marrying her dad. She was also fleeing someone defiling her chastity. So again, she denies her father. She's like, Dad, your parents just don't understand, is what she said. And the father, and so both Dimphna and her priest were executed by beheading right then and there in Belgium, in the town they'd been residing in for a while. And Damon and his cronies went back to Ireland, and the story seemingly ends there.
Hmm.
So the residents of the town, who of course loved both of these people dearly, would bury both of their remains, and for many centuries this story would kind of remain dormant and not really go anywhere. Then in 1349, about 600 or 700 years later, apparently in this town they had preserved the memory of these two extremely pious people who fought to preserve their faith in the face of oppressive and evil paganism. And so with their memory still a big part of the heritage of this town, in 1349, they built a church over their remains. And that church was dedicated to Dimphna.
Hmm.
And because they were both known not just for their overwhelming faith, but also for their care for the sick, this church became a pilgrimage site, which was a place that Christians from all over the world, probably mostly Europe at this point in time, would travel to, because there were oftentimes relics of remains of the saints' bodies, or things that they could kind of appeal to be blessed or healed or to have a miracle performed. And so specifically, people with very serious mental illnesses or some kind of cognitive disorder were coming to this little town so that they could kind of intercede to Saint Dimphna and be healed.
Why people with mental illnesses in particular?
I'm not entirely sure. It may have been because those were the people that were kind of taken care of the most when she was still alive, but they just kind of gravitated in that direction and it's going to kind of stay there. And so, in 1349, the church goes up. Eventually, Dimphna's story would be recognized by the Catholic Church and she would be made into a saint. And this location is going to get very famous as a place where people with severe illnesses would go and receive miraculous healing.
Oh, so this is like an actual like canon saint, unlike Wilgefortis. Yes.
Right. Yeah. There's like some folkiness to her story, sure. But I think she is 100% recognized.
Nice.
And so, so you've got this small town in Belgium in a pretty rural area where you've got a ton of people coming to get healed. And so gradually they recognize, well, shoot, we don't have enough places to accommodate all of the people who are coming. So they build and they expand on the church to allow for people who are traveling there to stay while they're there. And even then, there's not enough to house them. And so what starts to transition here, and this is where we maybe kind of cross the bridge from what seems fantastical into what is actually deeply historical, is that the people of this town decided, as like the resting place for this saint who has historically meant so much to them, that they would take it upon themselves to house and provide for the people who were coming to seek a blessing. Mm. And often these were people who had, you know, they wouldn't have diagnosed it correctly back then, but they would have had things like schizophrenia. They may have had like some kind of like long-term brain damage, or I would imagine people like with Down syndrome and things like that. And so they were coming to this place to get blessed. And what they would find was the community would say, well, hey, you can actually come and stay with me. And they would live in the residents' houses. And often they would like work their fields with them, and they would provide food for them, and they would just become integrated into their community. They became kind of a part of the family.
I could see that picking up a lot of speed and contributing to more and more people with mental illness traveling here.
Yeah.
Kind of the first couple show up, or maybe the first few showed up not because they thought that it was particularly special for people with special needs, but the church there, knowing her story, just automatically cared for these people. I could see that. That's how these sorts of things tend to work.
Yeah.
It's like people hear, oh, like there's this church in this town that will care for people like me, and then they'll go there.
Oh, yeah. And you got to think, like, this was not a time where people really knew how to deal with people who had severe mental disorders, because, like, Having a severe disability itself was very crippling. I mean, we see examples of that just like in the Gospels. But to have like a mental illness, I think, was really challenging, because there wasn't like a visible thing that someone could be like, oh, you're blind, you can't see, or oh, you only have one leg. Having like a severe mental disorder, I think if you talked to people and said, oh, well, I have these visions of, you know, demons attacking me, you're probably thinking this guy's got some kind of spiritual problem. And so they were not thinking quite of how this could be treated. And I'm sure that families took care of these people a lot, but they were not kind of given a place in the community. And yes, so the reputation of this town really did grow. And I think there was a point in, let me check my notes. There was a point in, I think, the 19th century where a third of the people living in this town, it was like over 2,000 people, were these boarders, were people who were coming to live there. One of my favorite things about this story is that in the 19th century, when the like asylum system starts to kind of grow throughout the West, and people start to think, oh, I know what we should do with these people with mental disorders. We should institutionalize them, and we should put them in these buildings, and we should isolate them from society and things like that. And they looked at the community at Giel and they were like, oh yeah, these guys are like super primitive. They don't know anything about science and how to actually care for people. But ironically, now like modern psychiatrists and people who study this are actually looking at the example of this town and being like, oh crap, like they actually knew exactly what they were doing.
Yeah.
And this was like a best practice.
That's really cool, because it oftentimes turns out that scientific practices do not conflict with gospel truths, but sometimes only serve to reinforce them. So to me, it's really cool to know that what was just an extension of these people's faith, and not just an extension of their faith, but a intentional practice of following this like model that had been given to them centuries before, resulted in this environment that I'm sure really brought about a lot of flourishing in the lives of these people struggling with these mental illnesses.
Yeah.
This is a story that means a lot to me. I've had many close friends in my life who've had pretty serious mental handicaps, and over the last few years, the last 7 or 8 years, my wife and I have had the opportunity to work a lot with the Tim Tebow Foundation.
Yeah.
Running the Night to Shine big celebratory dance night once a year here in Tucson. And so we interact a lot with the people in our community here. One thing that I feel like is lacking from that is it's just one night, you know?
Yeah.
And the attendees that gather are told very clearly that they are of worth and value because they're made by God. And it's a very Christian-oriented night, but it is just one night in one place. And there's some churches here in Tucson that are better than others at caring for people with special needs. But really what I think manifestation of the kingdom of heaven looks like is this sustained care that this town models really well, even to this day.
So, and I was actually wrong. So the peak of the program was in 1930, where there were 4,000 boarders.
Wow.
And it was a quarter of the town's population. Wow. Which is really incredible to think about. It does still exist today. It's understandably much smaller for a lot of reasons, some understandable, some not so much. One is just that Europe's not that agrarian anymore, and they don't have a bunch of farms that need to be worked by average, you know, just an extra pair of hands. So that's kind of a struggle at offering work. But also, you know, there's the side that psychiatric medicine has improved a lot, and there are a lot of like kind of state funded resources that can help people in that situation. And, you know, psychopharmaceutical medicine has improved a lot, which, you know, has helped too. So
there's also the reality that through genetic testing that's able to be done in the womb now, a lot of mothers in the West are counseled, or at least given the option to have an abortion if it's known that their child is going to have a serious physical or mental handicap.
Yeah.
So we've seen, and I mean the numbers are there. You can look them up. We've seen in the West and a sharp decrease in the amount of people, the amount of, it turns into like the amount of adults that you see in public that have special needs. That's kind of a dark underbelly of that
conversation. Dude, and that just totally like bums me out so much, because I'm in a similar place as you. Like, this is a very important thing to me, like, personally, because I have an older sister who has an intellectual disability. She's been involved in, you know, Special Olympics for a very long time. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I've been volunteering with for the past couple of years.
Yeah, and you got your church involved this last year, too.
Yeah, that was one of the coolest, like, moments of ministry for me, dude, was being able to bring people in the community that I'm shepherding to, like, care about that. That's just, like touched my heart so much, dude. But yeah, well, it kills me because, like, people will say, well, it's understandable to want to terminate a pregnancy if someone is going to have a lesser quality of life. Because it's like, dude, have you ever, like, had a conversation with someone with, like, Down syndrome or, like, severe autism?
Such a pernicious
lie.
It's
like, they're, like, the most joyful human beings you'll ever talk to. They're just having a great time.
Yeah.
And, like, one myth that I think that is currently being debunked is just the level of autonomy they're often capable of. Like, seeing them as just, like, I don't know, a drain on the system. One, what a remarkably unchristian posture to have. But also, just like, I mean, the dudes who, like, I coach, like, they have jobs, they use public transportation, which in a city as big and hot as ours is not an easy thing.
Yeah.
Like, they're very capable of taking care of themselves. So yeah, that whole notion of, like, let's not burden ourselves with a child that will have too many problems is just,
yep,
that's anti-parenthood.
Yep.
It's awful. But what I really love about this story, and I think you hit the nail on the head when you mentioned the kingdom of heaven, like, one thing we do at our church at Mission is every week we invite a different person from our church to lead us in the Lord's Prayer, and we have them write little sections after each line of the Lord's Prayer. So they'll say, like, our Father in heaven, and then something about that, and then, you know, give us this day, yada yada. And I remember we had someone in our church say, what does thy kingdom come mean? Like, what am I praying for when I say that? And I had to kind of pause and think about it, and it's like, well, we recognize that sin in all of its faculties reigns supreme over creation right now. Even Jesus, when he was speaking to his disciples and to some of the scribes, speaks of Satan as, like, the strong man. Like, we see Satan interacting with our world, and we see that in the sin of our hearts, we see that in kind of the disintegration of human nature, and we see that in how people treat each other, how people treat God, how people treat themselves. And so it's like, the kingdom of God is the restoration of that. And so you think, you look at these people who hundreds and hundreds of years ago were born vulnerable and were born in a place where they were set up to be disadvantaged by their community. There was very limited medicine and resources to support and treat them. And if their families chose to neglect them and not take care of them, that's just what would happen. And so to think, now you have this community who, out of a heritage from the church and from this maybe mythical Irish girl, maybe not, they've taken on this mantle of, we are going to facilitate the kingdom of God in our small town of a few thousand Belgian people, and we're going to give people the things that they were made for: community, work, love, family, support, like a place of belonging. And to me, I'm like, this is what every church should be. Like, this is what every church should strive to be, especially for, like, some of the displaced and disabled in our communities.
Yeah, let me read that. Made what you were just talking about made me think of two quotes. The first is kind of maybe like the origin of this idea, which is Augustine from the City of God. He says, the whole of history since the ascension of Jesus into heaven is concerned with one work only, the building and perfecting of this city of God. And he's envisioning, like, this, you know, future New Jerusalem that we see the vision and revelation of descending upon the earth. And what's going on in this age right now is that the church is like this picture, when it's gathered, should be this picture of, like, heavenly realities of the kingdom of heaven, and that includes how people are treated. There's a second quote I wanted to read you is from Peter Lightheart, and he talks about, he says, this is from his Theopolitan vision. He says, "I'm going to show that the church is an outpost of the future city of God. The city of God exists now in the present as a real life society among the societies of men. This real world visible community is the family of the Father, the body of the Son, the temple of the Spirit. It exists to transform and renew human societies inside and out, top to bottom. Mm-hmm. As God's city, the churches carries out a global mission of urban renewal."
Yeah. 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 I love just, I love both of those quotes. I mean, Augustine certified. Mm-hmm. And, I think that having this understanding is so valuable because I have seen churches where it almost seems like the church's primary role is to serve those who show up there. Like if you drive to church at 10:30 on a Sunday at this address, the church will provide for you, but it owes nothing to the community around it. It owes nothing to the neighborhood around it. It owes nothing to the city in which it belongs. And I just like, that kind of irks me, you know? It's not my biggest irk of everything that we're bringing to the table, because Lord knows I've got plenty of specks in my eye, planks too. But there, yeah, to this idea of like, are we as the children of God striving to facilitate a healing response to the brokenness around us? And there's so many ways we can do that. And I think that just for me, providing a place of shelter and belonging for those who are just likely to be left out in a cold and heartless world is just, it's such an easy but beautiful way to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep.
So
sweet.
So there we go. Yeah, that's Dimphna and the city of Giel. And hey, if you're from Giel and you're listening to this, well, I don't know any Belgian. No, it's not Belgian. It's Flemish. Well, it's technically Dutch. Hold on. You say something for a second, Tommy. I'm going to look up something.
Well, did we talk about, I think we, yeah, you mentioned that Dimphna is the patron saint of mental illness.
I did yep. mention that.
One thing that I don't think you mentioned that I found here, a little last note. The U.S. National Shrine of St. Dimphna is located inside St. Mary's Catholic Church in Massillon, Ohio.
Oh, wow.
The shrine was destroyed by a fire in 2015, but reopened in 2016 and is still open to pilgrims and visitors. So if you live in Ohio, go check out the Shrine of St. Dimphna. And let's see, there's a St. Dimphna's special school in Ireland.
Hey,
where she came from.
That's
right?
Pretty cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
And if you're in the town of Giel, I just want to say from the bottom of my heart, bedankt voor het doen wat je doet.
What was that first word again?
Bedankt. Bedankt voor het doen wat je doet.
That was pretty good, man. That sounded, was that Dutch?
That was Dutch. Yeah. Which just translates to thanks for doing what you do.
Yeah.
So if you're, if you want to correct my Dutch,
I know at least one of our listeners can speak fluent Dutch. Two of them, actually.
Really?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
You'll have to tell me.
Some friends of mine in Texas.
So oh, okay, cool.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, hey, that's for them.
Yep.
Yeah. Bedankt voor het doen wat je doet. All right, Mazel Tov. All right, team. Thanks for tuning in. We will catch you guys real soon.
God bless you.
Bye-bye.